KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there, whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, January 20th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Leibick with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Yarrow.
And get the war drums ready, because we're going to be talking about a berry-cheeked, battle-ready fish, the war paint shiner. What's that you got there on your cheeks there, Katrina? It reminds me, did you ever watch that Tarantino movie, Inglourious Bastards, where they're over in Germany and everything?
Yeah.
It reminds me, and I was thinking about this actually before you got on, but now that you've got the streaks on your face, right before like the final showdown, Shoshana, she was putting on the red rouge under her cheeks, and like it was war paint and stuff, and it was very reminiscent of what you're wearing right now of this fish, the war paint shiner. So I didn't know that you were going to be doing this, but I'm very pleased. It's very much in the spirit. It looks very good.
I figured you would have some on as well, but I guess you don't have any makeup handy.
I don't own any makeup. Rouge, lipstick, other types, whatever they may be.
Let's get into the description. I know that this fish is from the southeast, so I assume you've caught some of these, and I would love for you to describe for us what it looks like.
Yeah, I have. So this is one of those fish. There's a few fish, the bluehead chubs, another one of them, but definitely the war paint shiner that when I got down to Georgia, I wasn't from Georgia. I was from out west in Utah, and we don't got a ton of fish diversity out there in the fish diversity that we do have. They don't get very colorful. Maybe some of the trout do. But when I first got to Georgia, I was taking an ichthyology class, and I just got to see some of the pictures of these fish around here. Of course, the pictures being chosen are the most vibrant ones.
Yeah.
But this is just a striking fish. And now, most of the fish's body is kind of reminiscent of typical shiners in terms of coloration. It's shiny, it's silvery. But then there's a couple places right on the cheek, right on the gill plate, the operculum there.
How'd I do? I do okay with my makeup?
In terms of placement, I think you're like spot on. It's perfect. And so, yeah, what Katrina's got, we didn't really describe the makeup. She's kind of got from like right below the eye on either side of her face, down the cheek to sort of right below the mouth. Just this big, wide, it kind of tapers at the top, tapers at the bottom, like a long torpedo-like streak of red. And that is what the war paint shiners have, right? It can get really bright red, sometimes orangey. We also get some of this color on the dorsal fin where you get that bright red right in the corner of the anterior part where it meets the body. And then you have this big black sort of stripe that covers the back half, the posterior half on the top of the dorsal fin. And on the caudal fin too, you also get this coloration of red and black. So it is this mix of red and black and silver. It's very much a Georgia fish. Go Dogs, the red and black, a great fish there.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, they're a beautiful striking fish, like you said, just lovely. And
one other coloration thing that you see on the war paint shiner that's worth mentioning is the lips, but particularly on those big individuals, the lips can get bright red. It's like they're wearing lipstick. Not as much as like the red lip batfish, which one of these days, Katrina, we're going to do the red lip batfish. But it is pretty noticeable that you can get those red mouth parts.
I couldn't find any lipstick, so I was going to do that and maybe make like a little mustache looking thing. But yeah, it looks like it's right on the lips. So that would have been a good addition. Maybe I'll be this for Halloween.
That would be good. Ah, well, I could dress up as a crescent shiner maybe.
They really just kind of grab your attention with their looks. And, you know, war paint and battle really convey something or conceal something, I guess. Or if you're in Britain, it's slang for makeup, according to the internet. Do we know why they have this kind of look? There could be multiple different reasons why they have it. So I think we could just talk generally about why things have bright colors.
I will say, I don't exactly know why they have this coloration specifically. I mean, you see across the animal kingdom, sometimes animals get bright colors for potential breeding purposes, for sometimes camouflage like on coral reefs. I don't think that's the case here.
Yeah, I mean, there could be a few different reasons, way of communicating something, whether it's to a male or a female, right? So it could be aggression related. If there's competition on the spawning grounds, it could be just kind of showing off to other males, could be showing off to females, but there's usually a number of different reasons why fish have markings, but this one is pretty striking and specific. And I don't know if you've caught them at different times of year. Do they always have this bright coloration, or is it just during the spawning season?
I've caught them with some pretty vibrant coloration all throughout the year. Okay. Although usually this fish I'm targeting sort of in the fall. A lot of these minnows are all kind of like late spring through summer spawners. I'm just trying to think through when I've caught them. I haven't noticed any sort of correlation between time of year and coloration, although I certainly could imagine if it is a breeding thing that the fish might just enhance that color during the spawning time. I definitely see there's a correlation between size of the fish and the strength of the color. A lot of times the small ones, you can still tell they're war paints. Like I said, kind of like a kind of just faint orangish streak across the cheek there, so you can tell that it's the species, but it's not strong at all. Then you get the big ones, like your giant,
they're like
5 inches.
Fecund. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like they're like a inch tall, 5 inches long, a behemoth war paint shiner. And those ones tend to be pretty colored up.
So we got a review from a listener named James last year, and he said he'd like to hear more scientific information such as cladistics on this show. And cladistics is basically how we categorize organisms into groups, sometimes called clades in the scientific community, based on their ancestry. And I really like this idea, especially for shiners. It's a pretty niche group of fish, meaning like if we went up to somebody on the street, I'm guessing someone's not going to know which fish are in this group unless maybe the NANFA conference was happening in town. So I would love to get to know where these fish sit on the fish family tree. So I thought we could kind of take some time to respond to James.
Well, you picked a messy episode to pull this out. I'll do my best for James. All life traces itself back to presumably a single origin. And from that, all life has irradiated and truly. And so you have all these forking paths. Some of them fade out and don't continue. But all the life that we see today has somehow... Hang on one second. There's this cat clawing at my door. I got to go put him somewhere else.
Okay.
I'm not stalling for time, Katrina. I actually do have a really good...
Sure. All right. Hopefully you had some time to figure out your answer.
No. So a clade is in any group that's monophyletic, which means it includes everything that's descended from any particular common ancestor. Now, the problem is it's really hard with these minnows, the leucicids, to actually figure out where things go. It's getting better with genomics, all this, you know, molecular techniques that people have these days. But historically, and even today, it's still quite a challenge. Oh, I got to catch my breath. I'm at altitude now of like 7,500 feet.
Turning hard with this answer, man.
Now, there's this genus Natropis that was essentially this catch-all bin for minnows where we didn't know where they go. Luxillus existed for a while as a subgenus within Natropis. And once we started being able to do more of this molecular testing, looking at the DNA of these fish, several of these genera were pulled out of Natropis and just elevated to genus level. Cypronella is another one. Luxillus is one of them. Pteranotropus, these are examples. So these are Luxillus.
Yep, and that's the genus.
The genus. Asterisk by that, and I'll explain that in a second. Luxillus, they're called the high-scale shiners. They got these really kind of tall scales on them. That's a characteristic throughout the genus. Really tall, narrow, diamond-shaped scales. That's how you know that you got a Luxillus.
Yeah, they're beautiful, too. I mean, that's kind of how they get that shine. The scales are really, they kind of pop. So, yeah.
Gorgeous fish, and there's 9 species in there. And I always sort of organize them into 4 categories in my head. And I found a research paper from the 70s that kind of confirmed my suspicions about which fish fall where. And so you've got these 3 that are sort of the, I call them the stripe shiner group, but it's the common shiner, the striped shiner, and the white shiner. Then you have the war paint shiner group, which is just the war paint shiner and the band fin shiner. You've got the bleeding shiner group, which is the bleeding shiner, the dusky striped shiner, and the cardinal shiner. And then all alone by itself, you have this thing that's the crescent shiner, a gorgeous fish. Gets really, all of these fish have their own unique thing, but I think the bleeding and the crescent are probably the two most beautiful. The crescent shiner is off sort of on its own thing. And so now I bring that up to say that there is actually a paper that came out in 2022 that's trying to look further into the systematics within the groupings within Natropis. And they brought in some of these fish that were historically thrown into Natropis as well. And they did some phylogenomics. And what they found was that the group that I just mentioned with war paints and band fins, that they actually were over sister to Hybopsis, which is historically another genus of these North American minnows. Hybopsis is a fun name to say. And so it may be that these guys actually are not within the genus Luxillus, that they should be in a separate genus by themselves, a pair they would call a Cocotus. It's sort of in flux. It's not clear. Some people recognize Cocotus. And now, granted, I love the name Luxillus for a genus. It's a diminutive of the Latin lux, meaning light. It was Raffinesque's best attempt to come up with a term for shiner, which was the common name at the time, is shiner. So it just means like little light. So it's like little shiny fish, Luxillus. Great genus name. So Luxillus cacogenus, great. And now, don't get me wrong, euphony should not be something that we consider when determining what genus to put something in. But if it were in Cocotus, it would be Cocotus cacogenus, which is a really fun thing to say. So I might be a little bit less apprehensive of recategorizing this fish just because I would get to say Cocotus cacogenus more.
It sounds like a great baby name if anyone's looking. Mm-hmm.
Which, what, Cocotus?
The whole thing.
Cocotus cacogenus.
I think it's really neat to look at the family trees. Like you said, we're not experts on this. You could dig in very deep and make a career out of it. But just in general, it's important to know what the leaves are, what the branches are. I mean, we don't want some of these leaves falling off or branches getting knocked off by our activities. So I think it is important to know, especially with fish like this, where it's just like it's a little shiny fish. You might not ever really dig that deep into it, but I think once you do start looking, it's pretty interesting to see the origins and get to know them a little better.
It is such a mess. Shiners are such a mess to try and figure out what these relationships are. It's going to be something that requires probably another decade plus of research to really hammer out. So apologies to James for not having one where we could really go into it better, other than saying that these fish may or may not be part of a particular genus.
Well, if the listeners out there enjoy this kind of information, we can try to add it in a little bit more. I do like it myself because I'm always kind of curious, like, just who's related.
Okay.
So we'll try to integrate that a little bit more.
Do it more. Find a fish where, or a group of fish where it's a little more clear.
Bowfin.
Well,
snail darter. Snail darter.
No more. Snail darter no more.
So these shiners, they're typically found in the eastern United States. Yes. What's the range of the war paint and how do they sit geographically with these other ones that you just mentioned?
Yeah. So mostly an eastern fish, the common shiner, for instance, can get as far west as Colorado and Wyoming and some of those Mississippi drainages in those states. We just talked about the tangerine darter, and it's got a very similar range to the tangerine darter. From kind of really far western Virginia, that little spot that kind of sticks out down along the headwaters of these Appalachian streams that flow into like the Tennessee River that goes into the Mississippi. And then it extends a little bit further west than the tangerine darter in some of these streams in northern Alabama that are part of the same drainage also contain the war paint shiner. Now, unlike the tangerine darter, which I know some people might use darters for bait, we've heard stories about that with things like candy darter, these shiners are very much a common bait fish that people have used historically. And so you look at the maps of where these fish occur, there's a lot of adjacent drainages, places where there are presumed introductions of the fish. Now, have we ever talked about stream capture on this show?
We have, I think, maybe with the log perch episode we did, but not extensively. That was a season or two ago, so it would be good to mention again.
So this is kind of a cool thing within zoogeography and looking at species distributions, particularly within freshwater fishes, which you think these ones that basically live up in headwater streams, they don't have a way of getting over mountains or anything, so they're kind of isolated. And it's less clear with the warpaint, but definitely with the band fin shiner, which I say is this sister species to the warpaint. The band fin shiner, its primary kind of home range is the ACF, the Apalachicola Chattahoochee Flint, Chattahoochee River and its headwaters. However, there is a population that is believed to be native in like the headwaters of the Savannah River, in things like the Chattooga River. And so ACF, the Chattahoochee, that flows into the Gulf of Mexico, the Savannah flows over into the Atlantic Ocean. And so how do these fish get from one place to another without being just moved there by people? And what's kind of the leading theory, and this is geologists looking at this, not just biologists, is that you have these really steep kind of rivers, headwaters on this Atlantic side of the Appalachians. The Appalachians are very old mountains. If you look at the outline of the shape of Georgia, up in the far northwest corner, it's kind of got this like Cro-Magnon brow sort of looking thing to it. And that's because it's following the river, it's the Chattooga River, and it just makes this hard right turn. And so historically, the Tallulah and the Chattooga Rivers flowed into the ACF basin. But then at some point, millions of years ago, the Tugaloo River just cut back into the mountains enough that it captured these drainages, and along with that, all the fish that were in there. So you have these shiners, like the bandfin, that exist in the ACF and then also in this little bit of the upper Savannah. And so there's some theories, like in South Carolina, that maybe some other small tributaries to the Tennessee River got captured that had war paint shiners in them, and so they might actually be a native species to some of these places on the Atlantic slope.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Super cool. Within that range, what kind of habitats can you find these in? Like, when you've been fishing for them, could you just describe what the areas look like where you find them? Is it clear water? Is it fast moving? What are the streams like?
I've caught all 9 of these shiner species, and I think with each one, I could put a pin within like 10 meters of where I caught my first one.
Dang. Like,
hyper specific.
Encyclopedia.
I got a good memory when it comes to shiners. It's a very fun slam to do. A very fun. I would recommend it. It's up there with like Amblypleides for very similar
And you can
reasons.
Do it again if they get into different groups. You can do a different slam. Yeah.
But so the very first one that I caught, and I got super excited, the first time that I went, and I was fishing up in Brevard with our, we had a little fishing club that I helped start down in Georgia, and we'd go up, and there's this cabin that the local Trout Unlimited would rent out, you know. The more people you got to go, the cheaper it would be to stay at the cabins. We got people sleeping on the floors. We just crammed as many folks as we could get in there, and it ended up being like just $40 for the weekend. It was great. And they got some great trout fishing. I caught like a 23-inch rainbow, I think, when I was up there. Even more exciting than that big rainbow on those DH waters in Brevard was I picked up my first war paint shiner. I mentioned this to say that these fish are living in really cold, clear, fast-flowing water. They're very trout-like minnows, I've heard them described. Actually, a buddy of mine who I worked under, Duncan Elkins, he was actually given a presentation, because there's not a ton of research that has been done on fish in this genus, the species in particular, that isn't specifically trying to parse out the phylogenetic aspect of it. There's not a ton looking at the ecology of the fish, but there is one paper I know, and I saw him present it one time. And he actually pointed me out in the eyes. He's like, "Guy, you've probably caught tons of war paint shiners when you're fishing for trout." And that is the case.
It's true.
Because
they
are probably one of the most trout-like shiners. They're occupying the same habitat. And this actually kind of connects to the point that you made earlier about not wanting to lose any of the branches on that tree of life. If we were to lose this fish, it would be indicative of really probably poor water quality. That's the reason why we would lose it, is that there's not proper habitat for this fish. If there's not proper habitat for this fish, that means that there's also not proper habitat for things that are maybe easier for folks to care about and connect with, like rainbow trout, like brook trout, for instance.
Yeah.
And so they are using that same, they want clean gravel, cold water, well oxygenated water.
Yeah. And are trout eating them, or is this an important prey species for some of the fish that people might like to actually catch?
Yeah, they absolutely are. You know, like any small fish is probably going to be prey for larger fish that can fit it in its mouth. And I'll relate it to the study that I was talking about that Duncan was presenting on, Dr. Elkins, I should say. Cajun Jay will share this episode with him. Let him know that I mentioned him, so I'll call him by his proper name. Dr. Elkins down at UGA, as far as I know, still. So his say, he put these fish in flow tanks, big flow chambers. Not as big as a river, but pretty big. And so he was looking to see what introduced rainbow trout did to the habitat, microhabitat usage of war paint shiners. I say it's one of the only studies looking at the kind of ecology of this fish. And the results, to summarize, as far as I can tell, were basically in the presence of rainbow trout, war paint shiners start to use larger home ranges and they occupy territories in faster moving water. And so you think the same thing, where do you fish for trout? You look for them in like these little pockets on these seams.
They want to chill, yeah. They don't want to be in the hardest, fastest water to swim in. Yeah,
it's about maximizing efficiency in terms of keeping yourself alive and keeping you in position to get food. So you want to be in slow water next to these areas where you're getting, it's where you would target trout, like behind a rock where you have lots of flow coming to the side, but the fish isn't having to expend a ton of energy to get that food. And so the shiners are the same way, but in the presence of a more predatory fish like a rainbow trout, these fish are using suboptimal habitats, potentially for their entire life. So who knows what that would do for the life expectancy or the lifespan of war paint shiners if you think, okay, instead of using your ideal habitat, you're forced to use this much faster water.
And higher
just
energy
energetically
use.
It's going to wear you down over the course of your life. And these fish only live like 4 years. They're eating the same things to try. If you do want to go out and catch them, you don't even need like micro fishing specific gear. Just use like a small, like a size 8, maybe a size 20, dry fly. They hit dries really well and it's fun. So I highly recommend. But I would suspect, I've seen the other fish be caught like out in Arkansas where I've been fishing for like dusky stripe and cardinal shiners, folks basically using seines or using cast nets to catch these fish. Now, in some places that's legal, in some places that's not legal. So you'd have to check your regulations on whether you're going to do that. And I'd say know your fish. Oftentimes, a lot of members of these species will congregate in very large schools, aggregations, shoals. You can pick off large numbers, and they're not threatened. I don't believe any particular species within this group is actually of conservation concern. Obviously, you want to keep your eye out in case something does happen, but for the time being, they're all doing quite well. I would say, certainly, if you're going to use some for bait fish, as a bait fish, only use it in the waters where you've captured it. Don't move it, because like I say, you look at the maps of where these fish are found and there's clear traces of where folks have moved them to the next drainage over and released them when they've become established.
Yeah, I'm thinking still on kind of the value of a fish like this. So this is a small fish. Some people might think a fish like this isn't important. Maybe it's worthless. But, in addition to them being like super cool looking, really important forage fish for larger fish, what might be the neatest thing is that they're important to freshwater mussels. So heel splitters, and I think it's the Tennessee heel splitter specifically. And we've talked about the importance of fish to these uniotted mussels on the show before. We've had a number of episodes. I'm thinking about log perch, moon eye episode. And then we actually did an episode in season 3 specifically on the freshwater mussels that we have here in the USA. And essentially, some fish are key to the mussel reproduction. I'd encourage folks to listen to some of those episodes. But mussels have developed these really clever ways to get their larvae, which are called glaucidia, to attach the passing fish. So essentially, the baby mussel rides on the fish, like in its gills for a few weeks, and then they get moved around to new places where they eventually drop off and live their very important and sedentary mussel life. And I always think it's really neat to learn about a fish that's actually targeted by these mussels. It's a really neat connection. And I know that mussels are super imperiled here in the US. I think they're one of the most imperiled groups of organisms we have due to things like habitat fragmentation and sedimentation. So some of the things would also affect a fish like this. Anyways, I think that's super cool. Important piece of this fish as well.
It is cool. And I will second what Katrina just said about how cool these mussels are. And some of them have lures and some of them release conglutinate packets. This is pure speculation. I don't know, but because...
And it's good to be curious. Even though we're not experts, like being curious about this kind of question where we don't know the answer, you start thinking about how it might happen and then yeah, come up with a hypothesis.
I'm guessing that the heel splitters probably do something along the lines of releasing these small conglutinant packets. They're floating downstream and the shiners are going to pick them off, as opposed to, you know, something like these lampsilus mussels that have something that mimics like a small fish, like a darter or a crayfish, and they flap it around. It's hard to tell when it's coming downstream at, you know, I was going to say a miles per hour or a flow, but it's more like a several body lengths per second is probably the best thing for talking about, yeah, you know, what the shiner sees, that you can't quite pick off, or you can't quite discern, is that food or is that not food? And well, then bam, baby's in your mouth.
It's interesting because the mussels are essentially fishing. So if you think about how you'd fish for this fish, yeah, you'd be using small bait. And then for a larger fish where they have the lure that looks like a fish, like that would be targeting something bigger perhaps than one of these smallish fish. So Guy, you mentioned kind of these four groups of shiners in this genus. Couldn't you give us a little more detail in terms of why they're named these names, or just interesting things about them as we're talking about this group in general?
Yeah, we got that striped shiner group, and these are real tall, real robust. And one way that you can tell the difference is the kind of colorations on the fins. The striped shiner itself kind of develops a pinkish color, and they also get kind of fatter heads, tubercles on their heads. And so the striped shiner, its scientific name or its specific epithet is Chrysocephalus. It means golden head. It kind of gets that goldish head when the males are in spawning condition. The white shiner, Albiolus, it's a very generally kind of plain fish, kind of orange on the fins. And the common shiner looks quite a bit like the white shiner. It gets more of a red or orange on the fins. The striped shiner gets the pink. The common shiner's specific epithet is Cornutus, which just means horn because of the tubercles that it develops, like all the other ones in that group. Also, I didn't realize the word cornet is derived from the same root as that. And, you know, a cornet being a horn, but a brass horn. But I guess originally the horns were made of horn. There you go. So crescent shiner, gorgeous. I'd say crescent shiner is probably the most beautiful when you get them in like high spawning colors. And so its Latin name is Sarasinus. Cerasinus. And that basically means cherry colored. And they really are, even more so than the striped shiner. They get really pink. And even when they're not in spawning colors, you have the scales that are these darker colors just periodically throughout the fish. The fins get rosy colored. The cheeks get this, just this really brilliant pink. Fantastic.
I'd say prettier
fish
than a rainbow trout, even maybe. Looking at your picture. Much pinker.
Probably half of these fish are prettier than the rainbow trout, I would say. I mean, there's some really good specimens of rainbow trout out there. I guess you would call it the bleeding shiner group. So the bleeding shiner itself is Lexillus zonatus. Zonatus is just a band. You have cardinalis, it's cardinal colored. And then you got Pillsbury, that's the dusky stripe named after Pillsbury, who collected the type specimen. But they all look pretty similar in that when they get into spawning colors, really bright red, bright red sort of under the lower jaw, through the cheek and in the eye, and the dark stripe that runs from the tip of their nose all the way to the caudal peduncle, and it's really thick. I'll be honest, I can't tell the difference between cardinal shiner and dusky stripe shiner except for like know where you are. So these guys are all sort of like the border between Arkansas and Missouri.
Those ones that you're just describing, they really look like you could see them in an aquarium. Like they rival some of those tropical looking fish in terms of their coloration. They're beautiful. They kind of remind me of a dace too, a little bit, with that stripe.
They do kind of look like that. And I've actually caught these. I've caught spawning cardinal shiners with southern red-bellied dace on stone roller pits. They're right in there with them. So yeah, they do kind of look like dace, kind of like the Chrysomys dace. They look similar in some respects other than like the mouth shape to like rosy side dace. Yep. But different genus.
Get to know your fish people. I think people know birds a little better. Maybe they can recognize them, but there are so many fish in the fish family tree. I think, 3.5 times more than birds probably, so... All this detail is kind of important to know. It's neat.
Yeah. And the one difference that you can kind of tell the bleeding shiner apart from the other two is that band up the anterior part of it, like as it gets closer to the gill cover, sort of above the pectoral fins, it kind of gets more broken up, doesn't have the same uniform thickness. So you can kind of tell the difference on that one. And the Crescent Shiner is like the White Shiner, the same kind of range, except for it's more restricted, more headwaters, it seems like.
Yeah. The more you look at pictures, I'm looking at your pictures in your background, guy, they do all look different. I mean, they've definitely got some similarities, but I can see how you've kind of grouped them. And yeah, they're definitely unique to each other and beautiful.
Yeah. If I had to group Crescent Shiner somewhere, I would put it with the Stripe Shiner group. But I do think it is on its own. So the band fin shiner, the common name kind of tells it all. It's on the dorsal fin, also on the caudal fin, but really on the dorsal fin. It's just got this one band, can be black, but I see a lot of times in, I think especially larger individuals, it kind of looks like iodine. It's sort of this orange, or like if you spill vanilla extract on your skin, you sort of get this like kind of translucent brown color. Yeah. It can be that color. And so in its name, so Zonisteus, Lexillus or Cocotus Zonisteus, that just means band fin. You think about like things like Istiophoriformes, that's the sail bearers. Well, I guess it's more band sail than it is band fin, but the sail being the dorsal fin.
Yeah.
And we actually haven't even gotten to the star of the show yet, Lexillus cacogenus. Cacogenus is, and this is actually probably the funnest name, it means berry cheek. I've been going through these names, and I just wanted to give a shout out to a resource that I use a ton and that I love. I started trying to do it myself, and then realized when I heard him speak at a conference that this project has already been done and it's ongoing. There's a guy, Christopher Sharpf. I always feel like I'm saying Sharpf? It wrong, but Sharpf.
Okay.
It's sharp with an F on the end. I still might be saying it wrong. Christopher, Sharpf, Sharpf.
Let us know, Chris.
He runs this thing called the Edifish Project, ETY fish, like etymology fish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the best resource that I know about in terms of trying to figure out the etymological origins of
fish. I was
wondering
how you were getting all that information on some of these episodes.
I'm
like,
divulging
Jesus,
my secrets. No.
Now I know. Okay.
Yeah. No, it would actually be cool to have him on sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that idea.
So thanks to Christopher Sharpf and the Edifish Project for all their help over the years. Go check
making
it out.
Guys sound smart on this show. It's awesome. So. How do you fight them when you catch them?
Oh, you just kind of lift them out of the water.
I'm joking.
And they're kind of nice tankara type species if you're on an area that's not particularly brushy. You fish with flies, but there's no reel. So really what you're doing is just kind of dapping around the stream. The first band fin I ever caught, it was actually on a cool project. You know, again, tying these fish to fish that maybe have more mainstream is there's a cool project that was privately funded by a guy down in Georgia. It was to try and identify waters where native brook trout still exist in the state. The state agency, there's not enough funding to do all the projects that you want to do. I mean, there never is. So this was like a chance to do some citizen science to go out and say, hey, are there trout here? Are there brook trout here? So I was assigned this spot up in the Chattahoochee National Forest. So it was mapped out like, oh, you go up this road. The road was closed. I had to hike like a mile and a half in and then bushwhack down this real steep valley. There was one rainbow trout, no brook trout, but I caught my first band fin shiners there. And I was catching them on the little, like, it was either a half weight or a three weight fly rod that I had. So that was fun. Yeah.
How long did it take you to get this lamb of all nine? How many years?
I think if you look at the shortest period of time in which I caught all of them, because I mean, you could look at it from the beginning, like when did I catch my first Lexillus to when did I catch my last? But I think the more appropriate thing to do is to look at, you know, the quickest time.
Did you cut them all?
Yeah. And I think it was a couple years. Now, granted, I wasn't really trying for it, but in 2021, Brian Zimmerman, he's got that cool cross the country species fishing derby that he runs. And I'd noticed I was catching a bunch of them. One time I was going out, my sister was graduating from college, so it was 2022, and I was making this trip kind of just across country. I was like, I'm going to see what I can catch. And I realized that I was very close to getting all of them. I picked up the dusky stripe. I picked up the cardinal. I actually didn't even know about that group of bleeding shiner Lexillus at the time.
Yeah,
I saw it on Instagram. Someone had just the most brilliant, just boldest bleeding shiner picture. It may have been Isaac Zabo or someone who had posted it. I forget who, but it was gorgeous. And I'm like, oh, I need to go catch that. But then I looked at the map on where it's found. I'm like, oh, that's
You're
further.
Like, sorry, sister.
Well, no.
Good luck at your graduation.
I went. I saw her graduate and everything, but it was further east. I'd already passed it. And I'm like, well, maybe when I come back. Then it took until 2023, actually coming back from the bleeding shiner was the last one I needed to get. Coming back from noodling those catfish with those guys in Oklahoma, I was trying to pick up some species. Within 30 minutes, I caught my first one, and I was expecting to catch another one, another several probably, because like I said, these guys are usually in big groups. If you catch one, you can catch, you know, dozens if you'd like. You just catch them until you get sick of it. But I fished the rest of the day, didn't see a single other bleeding shiner, and the one I caught was ugly as far as shiners are concerned.
Poor guy.
Talk about the first crescent shiner I caught was on this little creek that's a trib to the Mayo River. No caudal fin. Caudal fin gone. The whole tail fin, both lobes just gone.
They're just kind of nubbing it through the water.
Yeah. First stripe shiner I caught, that was on the day that I actually met Casper Cox on Big Swan Creek.
Speaking of Casper, could you get a slam with shiners by snorkeling and just seeing them? Does that count?
It would. I mean, it's a different sort of thing. That's one of the nice things about fishing that you can't really do with birds is, and I don't know if it's an ethical problem or just a society, like how we view things, but, you know, trapping birds is not, it's frowned upon generally.
You can get hunting slams.
You can get hunting slams. That's true. Yeah. That's true. Like turkeys, like the North American turkey.
But not like songbirds. You're not going to get a migratory bird slam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, no, for sure. And I actually keep multiple lists. I keep lists of fish that I've observed as well as fish that I've captured. Now, the observed list just runs the gamut, everything from, you know, sampled during classes, sampled during field work, snorkeled with, caught. So just everything like that. But then I do keep the separate caught one. But yeah, people could definitely fish worth snorkeling with. After I caught that bleeding shiner, I then switched over to snorkel fishing. It was great fun. That because you can combine the two.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
The thing that I think makes this actually one of my favorite slams out there, and again, it's a kind of a similar idea to the Amblypleides. You have these fish that are actually really distinct for the most part, with the exception of the dusky stripe and the cardinal. You can tell all of them apart from one another. And then they do cover this wide geographic range. It's not too hard. It's not like you have to go all around the world. Like I say, I think I could do it in a week of driving and hitting these spots. You know, you'd have to hit sort of that North Carolina, Virginia spot where you have the crescent and the white shiners. That's an obligation. Then you have to get out to where the cardinal shiner is in sort of western Arkansas, Missouri. The thing is, when you find these fish, they're usually pretty easy to find. If you can get to the right habitat and you can get to the right geography, you don't have to be a particularly skilled fisherman to catch them. Just use small bug-like looking things. The chub grub works well, or little flies, and you can pick them up. So it's a great motivation for a road trip if anyone's looking to do that. That'd be a week continuous, and even then it might be less than that. But if you have like a long weekend and you can go to, you know, North Carolina, a 3-day weekend in North Carolina, you could knock off probably about half of them, North Carolina, Tennessee. Then you take another weekend and you go out to Arkansas, you could knock out basically the rest, go down to Georgia for one of them, maybe during that North Carolina trip. Yeah, so it's not particularly hard to do. It's a great way to see the country. It was a really fun one. Like I say, 9 species is a bit much, but because they're not super hard to find and catch, it's
makes
great.
It doable. Yeah, you got some of those people that try to climb those mountain peaks, you know, like all the top mountains in 1 year. But yeah, this seems like an attainable goal to have. So really cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. I think that's a wrap. Get out there and get your shiner slam done. You can catch them, you can snorkel for them, and also just live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, especially the warpoint shiner. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
This old world may never change, not the way it's been. Think of me. Thank you.
How much longer will it be till we cross that Mason-Dixon line? At daylight, would you tell that engineer to slow it down? Or better still, just stop the train, cause I want to look around. Hey, porter, hey, porter, what time did you say? How much longer will it be till I can see the light of day? When we hit Dixie, will you tell that engineer to ring his bell? And ask everybody that ain't asleep to stand right up and yell. Hey, porter, it's getting light outside. This old train is puffing smoke and I have to strain my eyes. But ask that engineer if he will blow his whistle, please. Cause I smell frost on cotton leaves and I feel that southern breeze. Hey, porter, please get my bags for me. I need nobody to tell me now that we're in Tennessee. Go tell that engineer to make that lonesome whistle scream. We're not so far from home, so take it easy on the steam. Hey porter, please open up the door. When they stop this train, I'm gonna get off first, cause I can't wait no more. Tell an engineer, I said thanks a lot and I didn't mind the fare. I'm gonna set my feet on southern soil and breathe that southern air.
There's a story spreading round about a stranger in our town. And the people say he's weird as he can be. Big sunglasses, a big black hat. They all stare and say, who's that? Up till now, they still don't know the stranger's me. Why would God if they found out I'm the fool they laughed about? After all the times they warned me, she would break my heart and leave. I've been living in disguise, hiding from a shameful life. Up till now, they still don't know a stranger's me. Change the style of clothes I wear, change the way I comb my hair. Friends are pointing fingers asking, who is he? My old self ain't been the same since my baby brought me shame. Up till now, they still don't know the stranger's me.
as if I were only a friend. What have I done that's made you so distant? Sometimes I wonder if you'll be contented again. Will you be happy, girl, when you are withered and old? Sorrow, you'd say.